to our panel discussion, further introduction of the many issues that will be discussed over the week ahead at the summit.
This will be led by our summit moderator and the glue behind much of the planning for Learning 2030, someone I've been working with very closely now for several months, Dr. Michael Brooks. He's been preparing the summit for nearly a year, reaching out to experts, helping to frame the discussion, and he's ready to unearth ideas and innovations in education that can improve our world.
Michael Brooks holds a PhD in quantum physics. He's a best-selling author, journalist, and broadcaster. As a consultant with New Scientist and columnist for The New Statesman, Michael keeps abreast of science news and current events and how that affects our political and cultural life. Michael has been a tremendous partner on the summit. His enthusiasm and journalistic rigor have infused Learning 2030 with incredible purpose and clarity. Over the course of the week ahead, he will moderate the daily panel discussions and help ensure that the summit outcomes are captured in the Equinox communique to be presented on October 3rd. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael Brooks and our distinguished panel.
So, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Over the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to introduce some of the themes at the summit by watching and then discussing our series of benchmark videos. These provide a launching point for our discussions throughout the week by helping us find a common starting point. They are future learning, realizing our children's potential, provision, education for everyone, endpoints, thinking and thriving, and tools, the 21st century classroom. Each video will provide us with a jumping-off point for further conversation with our panel of experts. So let me now take a moment just to introduce you to our distinguished guests. At the end here, we have Graham Brown Martin, who has a very odd resume. As an entrepreneur, he sold technology companies to Philips Electronics and Virgin Interactive. He has directed music videos for The Fall and Malcolm McLaren, among others. He co-designed the ship's computer for the feature film Lost in Space, but he's here in his role as the founder of Education Design Labs. Graham is currently in the middle of a world tour to study the implementation of digital technology everywhere from Silicon Valley to Western Africa, and he joins us having just visited projects in Syria and Beirut, and he thought that Waterloo was the next natural stop. Next to Graham, we have Penny Milton, who is an exemplary lifelong learner. After more than 14 years as CEO of the Canadian Education Association, she retired in 2010, she says, in order to learn to paint. So she is a past chair of the Toronto Board of Education. Thanks for joining us here. Next, we have Guillaume Sintra, who trained as an economist and got his first job in the financial industry. Having discovered this to be a rather unsatisfying way to spend one's life, he says, he's now an analyst for Gera, a Brazilian investment company that is working to develop high-quality but reasonably priced schools. And here next to me, we have Susan Opok, who directs the Ugandan operation of an NGO called PEAS, Promoting Equality in African Schools, which works to give all African children access to affordable, high-quality secondary education. And it is working. PEAS schools welcome students from disadvantaged families, yet their students often perform better than the national average on government tests. Though rooted in Uganda, PEAS is actually working also in Zambia and is expanding into Rwanda. So welcome to all our panel. We're going to begin by viewing the first of our benchmark videos, which examines in a nutshell why there is global concern about how we educate today's children. And then we'll see what our experts are concerned about and have a discussion. So let's take a look at video one.
In the last 12 months, the world has welcomed the birth of 134 million children. Their high school graduation date is 2030. By current estimates, 61 million of them will never get to high school, let alone graduate. not unless something in education changes, and quickly. Most of us had a factory schooling in an education system designed, conceived, and structured for a different era. Born out of the intellectual culture of the Enlightenment and economic model of the Industrial Revolution, school buildings, the school day, and the educational model used throughout the 20th century were largely based on the principles of factories. Subjects are separated, and children are educated in batches determined by the year of their birth. Bells ring in the same way they did when they were there to teach the future workforce about being punctual and efficient and responding to commands. Although the delivery method has changed, knowledge is still handed down from authority figures while the students sit meekly in their allotted place. Even the school day and the school year were designed for another era, when children had to be let out to work in fields, and when there was always someone at home at 3 in the afternoon. The goal was to transfer knowledge, but it created uniformity and engendered conformity. Though enlightened educators are moving away from this model in a few regions and districts, the movement is fragmented, lacking clear goals, and far too slow. This kind of industrial schooling has created an epidemic of apathy towards learning. By the time they reach high school, as many as 40 to 60% of all students, urban, suburban, and rural, are chronically disengaged from school. For every 10 children who start school, 4 drop out in sub-Saharan Africa, 3 in South and West Asia, 2 in Latin America and the Caribbean. 31 million of the world's children have dropped out of school and may never return. That is a tragic loss to all of us. To miss out on a solid education is to miss out on one of life's most rewarding and satisfying experiences. What's more, every additional year spent in school increases personal income by 10%. Statistics and studies bear out that staying in school is a road to better prospects, a more fulfilling life, and better health. But also because the next generation will be facing a radically different world than the one our educational system is preparing them for. The job market will be drastically different. The last 2 decades have brought us a completely different world, and the next 2 decades will likely create professions, products, services, and opportunities that don't yet exist. Those who make it and graduate in 2030 will need to solve some of the most complex global challenges facing humanity. At the moment, we aren't aligned on how to tackle climate change or deal with shortages of energy, water, and food that are likely to impact on a planet that will be populated by 8.3 billion people in 2030. We will need the full force of this generation's creativity and imagination. It would be calamitous for us to miss out on the next Einstein, Curie, or Mandela. That's why there is an urgency to improve the system, because we are failing to maximize the potential of children currently in the system. We're going to need to be adaptable and flexible moving forward. We need to ask some important questions. How will we give these children the tools to solve big problems and realize new opportunities? What will those tools be? How do we ensure that the children born this year are ready for their life, a life they get to choose in 2030 and beyond? Simply put, how do we take learning into the 21st century?
Okay. Penny, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to start with the big question. Do you think we really need to reinvent school, or can we evolve it from where we are now?
I just have to say something first, and that's a thank you to the participants. As I watched the movie, it just occurred to me that I have 2 grandchildren that will be in that class of 2030, so it's become very personal. Yes, we need a new model. We need to reinvent school. We could extend the mechanical metaphor and think about the institution of school as being made up of all these different components. There's the physical structure. There's the timetable. There's the class schedule. There is the curriculum. There is this unit and that unit. There's teacher training. And on it goes. That you can't get where we want to go and get intellectually, emotionally engaged students by dealing with pieces of it. So it's a reinvention.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And Guillaume, let me ask you from your experience in Brazil. How do we get past the problem of lack of engagement? I know that's an issue that you face looking at education in Brazil. I mean, is it possible to get students excited about school?
Yeah, it is. It is a pretty tough thing to do, but I really liked what Brendan was saying because it really highlighted some of the problems we had in Brazil. So when you go to a high school in Brazil, you see really disengaged students. They don't really understand why they're here, what is expected of them, and when they're faced with the decision of being in school or going to the workforce, a lot of them just decide to disengage in school just to go to the workforce because this way they feel that they're going to get the appropriate skills they need. But for you to really change what's happening in Brazil, you really have to get your teachers to be interested in what they're doing, so they have to be really engaged in what they're doing, and that's the main issue you have in Brazil. You really have to redesign curriculum completely so that students feel that their skills are being improved in terms of really solving real-world problems. That's not what's happening right now.
Okay. And Susan, let me ask you, your experience with the Ugandan system, do you recognize this one-size-fits-all model and the kinds of problems that it can generate?
Yes, in Uganda, the one-size-fits-all is a systemic issue because the school is looked at as the structure and the curricula. So the children that go to school are supposed to go through a curricula that predetermines their learning. However, the challenge comes in asking whether all children will learn in this situation where the curricula is a one-size-fits-all. Many times what happens is the high achievers actually learn, but they learn, they may get knowledge, information, and not the skills that they can apply. So that leaves the slow and average students without an education. And the question is, how can we ensure that education is actually for everyone, and not only for the high achievers, but also that it provides skills? So there is a lot to do, and we are trying to see and engage the government of Uganda to see how we can actually improve the education system and ensure that the one-size-fits-all is not the system that should be taken on.
Right, thank you. I mean, it's great that we've got this amazing kind of global perspective in the room today. Graham, you've been kind of traveling around the world. Do you see any way to prepare students for the future, for 2030? I mean, is there a change afoot now? Is something shifting when people are realizing that things will have to change?
Yeah, I think there's a general consensus amongst many of the educators and thought leaders that I've been meeting. I'm from all the way from sort of Ghana, for example, through Cuba, to recently Beirut and Jordan. The common theme is that change, we need to transform. There is an imperative underneath, but it seems more of an unconscious thing. This isn't necessarily happening at policymaker level. There's a sense that the underlying shift in society, the underlying basis of society is shifting. And we hear a lot about the switch from the agricultural economy to the industrial economy. Yeah. And now are we switching to the digital economy, and what does that mean? And a collapse in the physical economy. So there is this sort of desire to transform. But we're seeing a tension between educators and thought leaders against policymakers.
Right.
And indeed, much of the innovation that we're beginning to see is actually happening from what we might call the developing countries, the developing world, as opposed to nations who are already scoring very highly on PISA and therefore don't see the need to change, or indeed have an education system which is simply producing compliant population.
Okay, thank you. We've got policymakers with us, so hopefully, you know, this consciousness, we can all sort of make this journey together, I'm hoping. So we're going to look at our second video right now, which is Provision, Education for Everyone.
All 134 million children born this year started life with largely similar potential. So why isn't the end result of their education similarly consistent? The simple and disappointing answer is that who you are and where you come from matters far more than it should. The 19th and 20th centuries saw huge increases in global inequality. The pathways through education have become similarly uneven. Geography is an issue. At the moment, the gap between the best and worst performing OECD countries is equivalent to holding back a student for 2 years. Another major obstacle on the learning highway is gender. Two out of three countries in the world face gender disparities in primary and secondary education. In northern Uganda, for instance, female enrollment in secondary education is 9%. And 66% of mothers in the region have no education at all. However, the greatest divide is between rich and poor. Simply being rich can put you a learning year ahead of students from average backgrounds. In fact, family income is the best predictor of children's success in school. But we know we don't have to continue along this road. 7% of 15-year-olds in OECD countries are unable to demonstrate basic reading skills. But measures put in place in Finland have brought this down to 1%. We need to adopt more such measures to learning. We know this is possible because in some regions it is already happening. In places such as China and Korea, some of the best performers can be found among the poorest students. In small pockets of success around the world, innovative approaches to learning are enabling disadvantaged students to succeed against all the odds. And in today's economic climate, with a focus on jobs and prosperity for all, there is good reason to pursue improvements in learning. Studies suggest that a ripple effect could create radical improvements in economic performance. The US alone could see a gross domestic product increase adding up to $72 trillion over the next two decades if all its students could meet a baseline of achievement. And if its students could perform, say, to the average performance of students in Finland, the US GDP could climb to $103 trillion over that period. Given the importance of education, it makes sense to identify the successful insights and programs, work out which of them can be scaled up and rolled out globally. It's time to make learning work for everyone. Everywhere.
Okay, there's a lot of statistics and figures in there. We'll come to the economics in a moment, but first of all, Susan, I wanted to ask you about that 66% in northern Uganda and the 9% of engagement with girls. The gender issues are a big deal for you, presumably, in your schools.
Yes, it is. Many times, parents in developing countries see girls as not, you know, they don't value girl-child education. The attitudes toward girl-child education is very negative, so there is a lot of work that needs to be done in order to support the child or the girl in school. This requires a lot of engagement with different stakeholders at different levels, and also to include the girl or the children in discussing the role and the value of education, because the issue is, what is education for? People have seen that many children have gone to school, many have come out of school and haven't got jobs, haven't got the skills, haven't got the critical attitudes that require them to be sustained within a world that is open to them. So there is a lot of issues that need to be analyzed and assessed, but also a lot of attitudes that need to be changed in order to support girl-child education.
And this is something that PEASE is doing in Uganda, I presume?
Yes, PEASE is trying to introduce a lot of new aspects within the education curricula, trying to introduce, ensure that facilities are provided to enable girls, you know, attend schools, because issues like menstrual cycles affect the girl-child. Children in developing areas, children in rural areas do not have the kind of attitude, the stamina, to be able to face the challenges that come with education, the environment that they go to. You find that when they are in the classroom, boys are more, you know, outspoken. They can be able to express themselves. So the issue is, where do you leave the girl? So now we are trying to see that there are some pedagogies that are introduced in the classroom to support the child, the girl child. Facilities are introduced in the school. There is a safety, you know, safety measures, fencing, latrines and so on, child protection issues are all introduced to support the girl child, so that they can also participate. The aspect about participation, is it actually critical to education?
Yeah.
So that is an issue that we are trying to deal with.
Okay, thank you. I mean, we're looking at these pockets of success that we've seen, but our goal at the end of that video is to make education work for everyone everywhere. Graham, do you think that's too lofty a goal? I mean, can it be done?
I think that you have to be careful to not view education through a sort of Western lens. I mean, we often hear the usual canards, you know, Khan Academy, Udacity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have to remember that, first of all, not, you know, the majority of people don't have access. Even though we hear about mobile and so on, I mean, the poorest people in the world have the most expensive data charges. So I think we need to, first of all, look at that one. I think there's also the context and the cultural aspects of education. I mean, for example, my work in the Zaatari refugee camp, you know, we look at humanitarian aid, water, food, warmth, sanitation, and so on, which is about maintaining life. When we start talking about education, yes, I mean, I think, you know, education is a right. I mean, it's a human right, and as much as a humanitarian one. But we are shaping futures, and then we get into, well, what kind of education and whose education, and it becomes deeply politicized. I think we have to be, I think as there's a sort of a mantra, the sort of technological determinants holding the agenda right now. We're saying, well, let's make everything digital. Let's just squirt it all out from Silicon Valley or fill in the blank. Yeah. I don't think that's going to work. On the flip side, though, I think there is, from my own experience and travels, enormous interest in moving things forward. Right. And I think that, as this summit has alluded to, there are enormous challenges that our children and our grandchildren face. And the only way we're going to meet that is to lift it together. And I think that's something that our generation and previous generations haven't been successful at. Right. And I think will be a key part of redefining education globally.
Okay. Penny, let me ask you. Few of us here are probably motivated by lifting our own country's GDP. You know, that's not a motivation for individuals. But is it a motivator for governments?
I think it is sometimes, although they don't make the direct link. You know, Canada seems to be consumed with the idea of international competitiveness. Yeah. So we watched the PISA scores very carefully. And when we started to drop down a little bit in the ranking, well, suddenly we redefined it as being the top English-speaking country, which I thought was pretty clever, right? But the equity issues are very real in Canada. The outcomes for Aboriginal peoples are unacceptable. The correlation between family wealth and school outcomes is still pretty intact, even though on international measures, PISA, we're one of them, we have some of the more equitable outcomes. But we have not solved the problem of fair chances for every child born in a country as rich as ours.
Right, okay. Guillaume, let me ask you this issue of health and happiness. I mean, wealth matters to people in Brazil, doesn't it? The education has to be something that will get them somewhere in terms of their life earnings.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of an emerging market country, in Brazil right now, education is becoming an increasingly sort of an inspiration for a lot of people. So you see a lot of people that are actually the first person of their family to go to university. And this is truly inspirational for the whole concept of the family. So their parents are happier. So their daughters will be happier. Everyone in the family values education more after that particular experience of that person. So in this term, for an emerging market country point of view, we really see education as something transformative. But that has to be become bigger in our perspective.
Right, okay. I mean, this is one of the things that we're really talking about this week is these very varied endpoints of education. So you can't just fix it and it works. You know, it depends on the context and where you want it to be. So Canada will be very different to Uganda. And I presume, Susan, that you know, you're not necessarily looking at higher education as an end goal of all your students.
No, the aspect about education should enable children get skills that they can utilize wherever they go. The issue is after an education, or when you've got an education, what is it that you remain with after you know you've forgotten everything? So that education should provide you that capability to move on, you know, thinking outside the box and not being in the box at all times.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, we're going to move on now and look at our third video, which is called Thinking and Thriving.
The 134 million children born this year face an exciting future. Some will create their own jobs. Some will create entire industries. Others will apply their critical thinking to solve problems humanity has wrestled with for decades and even centuries. Some will be artists or athletes. Some will lead their generation, others will simply lead their families. Whatever these students decide to do with their lives, their education should be a help, not a hindrance. The question is, can the system we currently have deliver the education the graduates of 2030 actually need? At the moment, high school education is largely skewed toward funneling students into higher education. And as good as that may have seemed in the past, it may be too one-dimensional for the future. Though some traditional careers will remain, many will one day work in industries that don't yet exist. Predictions for future jobs include exotic positions such as memory augmentation surgeon, time broker, and weather modification enforcement officer. While we can't predict exactly what kind of job the graduate of 2030 can expect, we can begin to think about what kind of education will serve them best. Thought leaders suggest that the most important education will involve learning how to learn and how to adapt to suit a fast-changing workplace. Is there a way to release students from the factory model of education into a flexible learning environment that keeps them agile and creative? The urgent question is, how do we create a learning experience that equips them for the opportunities 2030 will bring?
Now, it's very easy to talk in general terms about 2030, these new open opportunities. But people are going to need jobs, and people are going to need to be ready for their jobs. So, Graham, is it okay to teach in schools with a view to people's future careers? Or should we actually just be focusing now on engendering a kind of love of learning and nothing more than that?
I think there's a real tension right there. It's the an age-old question, isn't it? I mean, is the role of education to produce productive forces of society, you know, factory workers as they have been, or now digital factory workers as we sort of shift and knee-jerk towards a digital world? Or is it about, in the John Dewey tradition, enlightenment, following your own line of inquiry, and what you love, and hoping that will add to society and yourself? And I'm sure that there's somewhere in the middle of that. The issue, of course, is that we just don't know what the world looks like in 2030. It doesn't matter what futurists say. You know, the future doesn't exist. It's not a place. It's what we make it. I mean, this is, we can say that, yes, there's going to be very, very fast processors. We know that zettascale computing will be around by 2030, which is 1,000 times the processing speed of the human brain. But that doesn't mean we have to allow society to change in that way. If we continue to shift as we are at the moment, with a rapid decline of the physical economy to the digital economy, we're seeing wealth and jobs being concentrated amongst an ever smaller number of people and an ever smaller number of corporations. You know, we as a society have to decide whether we're happy with that. And whether we want to see a renaissance of the physical economy. We're seeing some aspects of that at the moment, but I don't think that that's happened yet. So I think when that reflects on education, I think we need to be thinking about, yes, learning to be able to learn, to unlearn and relearn, as Alvin Toffler once said, is vital, but also it's the real skills, the real doing skills. We know we're seeing a lot of excitement around 3D printing, but you know, a potter's wheel's pretty good. and we just need to get things in the right order that way. So I think to answer the question is that there has to be some sense of what you are going to do in life, what you're going to love. But I think if it's all about, as we have done with the Industrial Revolution and the factory school, which is turning agricultural workers into factory workers, of course, that will fail.
Right. Okay. Penny, do you want to come in on that?
Well, I think this idea that schools were about turning out industrial workers is kind of a bit overdone. This tension between preparation for work and becoming human has been there forever. We have actually always known how to create or support the development of human beings like the ones that are aspired to in terms of these notions of 21st century competencies. We've always done it. It's just been we've done it for a few. You know, the big challenge that we face, at least in the Western model of education, is how do you give that kind of experience, which I would argue leads to well-being and engagement in all spheres of adult life, how do you make that possible for all kids and not just for some?
Well, of course, that's a big issue when we're facing the kind of dialogues that we're having this week. So I know that Guillaume and Susan were saying that, their situations in the countries in which they're working are very different to Canada, United States, Western Europe. I mean, wouldn't you say that's the case, Guillaume?
Yeah, for sure. It's you always have to look at the context when you're thinking about what kind of solution you're trying to create. So sometimes in these discussions, we got high-level discussions thinking about how the 2030 world we're going to completely change. And when you look at Brazilian situation, you see that a lot of these people don't really understand how they're supposed to work in this society right now, and they're not really capable of trying to think out of the box to see how the future is going to work. So when you think about this different context, you have different challenges that you have to face in different ways. So it's not a universal solution we're going to have. We're just going to have a blueprint that has to address this sort of differences.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah. And we're getting very excited about digital technologies. Is that on your radar, really?
Yes, there is a thought about digital technologies, but the applicability, you know, is something different, because in our situation, you go to rural areas in developing countries, there is no electricity, there is no lighting, there is no, you know, phone. We can't use the basic and new technology that the advanced countries seem to use. And that seems to be the basis of education, or, you know, the outlook today. Now, the question is, how do we support being in a global environment, being in a global world? How do we bring the developing world, you know, into the status quo? So the issue is to how to balance what the developed world has and what the developing world has to catch up with, and whose responsibility is it? I know that once upon a time, for instance, you know, the developing world or people in Uganda would think that, you know, if you went for a technical school, then you're a failure. But it looks like today people are beginning to prefer, you know, the skills rather than, you know, going to a university, because now there seems to be a dichotomy between, you know, this, what should somebody do? So I think there is a lot to discuss and talk about in order to shape the education for tomorrow.
Right, okay. And Penny, let me just come back to you on issues of shaping education sort of from on high, as it were. I mean, we want a future where students come out and they know how to learn, because that gives them the flexibility. Absolutely. Is it possible to impose something that will allow that to happen?
Well, I don't think it's an imposition.
That's a terrible word. Right.
Yeah. I think it's actually a way of interaction. It's the quality of the work that kids are asked to do. It's the teacher, and I am not really one of the people that say teachers facilitate. Teachers that know how to teach actually know how to help a student reflect on what they're doing, how to make it better. So it's the whole piece in a way. I mean, it's assessment as well as that the work be worthwhile. It absolutely is essential that it engages the kids' hearts and not just their intellect.
Right.
I mean, it is an emotional investment that is necessary. I'm not too sure what learning skills are. So I wouldn't necessarily assume that they can be taught directly. But as I watch these now multiple grandchildren of mine, there's a human capacity to learn,
yeah,
that I think needs to be examined and formalized and nurtured. And part of it is us shifting our notion of what is learning, so that we're no longer thinking about you have to be able to remember. Remembering is pretty important in learning, but it's not core. You know, it's when you're a different person, when you know and understand something that you didn't before, you don't forget it.
Yeah. So we're going to look now at the real nuts and bolts of learning in our final video. So, I mean, this is something that's rarely out of the news agenda these days, you know, how you incorporate technology, for instance, without losing that focus on just learning rather than the thing that's in front of you. So let's have a look at this final video.
Education as we know it began with a priest passing knowledge to specially chosen initiates. Then from tutors to privileged pupils. Then from teachers to large classes in the factory model. As students, we have learned by rote, by copying from written texts, by instruction from authority, This form of education hasn't accommodated individual differences amongst learners. We have processed students in batches, which has created disparity and a barrier to higher scholastic achievement. Although we are starting to see new and exciting routes to learning, we are also facing some difficult decisions regarding the three main pillars that create a strong education: the tools, the teacher, and the test. All are important, but no single one is strong enough to raise achievement alone. When it comes to learning tools, the digital age brings us many opportunities. Tablet computers allow multiple textbooks to be held in the hand and are flexible, updatable, and interactive. Course materials placed online give access to those in remote and less developed parts of the world. Social networking creates unprecedented opportunities for peer-to-peer learning. The teacher's role is changing too. In transitioning from deliverers of knowledge, they are now facilitators who help students grow their learning skills. They have traditionally stood at the front of a class delivering knowledge. Now they can be found helping students teach each other, or even teaching students on another continent. Today, one teacher can reach millions via video on the internet. In this new educational environment, we have a chance to reassess what makes great teachers and how they might reach and inspire as many students as possible. The final pillar is the test, educational assessment. What is the best way to gauge the progress of learners? Exams on the curriculum, or more general tests of learning ability? Or is there another way entirely? We are in the midst of a huge experiment, and we don't yet know what works. Are tablets that much more engaging than chalkboards? Does being alone with an internet connection create a better learning experience than struggling through alongside your peers? Are massive online courses just creating bigger batches? It is vital that we answer these questions quickly and push global achievement as high as this age of new opportunities will allow.
So, lots of great questions there. Let me ask you one, Graham. Are tablet computers that much more engaging than chalkboards?
I think we're in danger of fetishizing technology, really. That it's like a sort of, it's the answer to everything. I mean, yes, they're fun, they're engaging, and so on. Are they more engaging than a chalkboard? I think there's a problem in their question. I mean, I've been visiting lots of different classrooms in lots of different countries, as you know. What I see is, even with technology, what you need is a really engaged, excited, passionate teacher. Mm. And this idea that we're going to need less teachers as a result of whatever technology that we use, it's a bit like the paperless office. In the 80s, it was about as useful as a paperless toilet. Do you know what I mean? I think we're going to need more teachers and different kinds of teachers. But I think that the other issue is that, just to switch back, I mean, the Victorians were actually very progressive. In their examination system, they allowed you to use the technology of the day in the examination room. You know, paper, pens, pencils, that kind of thing. We don't. You know, we don't allow the technology of the day. So if today the tablet happens to be the technology of the day, why aren't we allowing that in the examination room? I mean, how would the teaching process change? How would the learning process, how would school change if we made it mandatory for a child to have that tablet computer in the examination room, to collaborate with their co-learners in the examination room, right, to find a subject specialist, to call their dad or whatever in order to solve the problem?
I think
at the moment, the tablet computer is irrelevant, because it has no bearing on the assessment. And I think that's the crying shame of where we are today.
Okay. We haven't talked a lot about teachers. You say we might need more teachers, not fewer. Susan, I know teachers, that's a resource for you, isn't it? A very important resource that you get right.
Yes, teachers are a resource. However, teachers also kind of inhibit learning because of their training. You know, they are, you know, focused on one aspect rather than, you know, allowing the child to, you know, to flourish by asking questions. It's, you know, it's a talk and chalk that happens in Uganda. You know, the teacher is the master of whatever is happening in the classrooms. So the issue is, how can we ensure that the children are actually engaged, that they can question the teacher and be able to understand and to be able to learn? So I think the teacher, for me, is the key to probably inhibiting education. And if we want children to learn, if we want and education, I think we need to deal with the teacher.
Right, and you've had some experience
in a positive manner, rather.
Put them in detention.
It's in a very positive manner, yeah.
So you've had experience of actually allowing some of your more able students to become teachers, have you not?
Yes, we are beginning to allow that. However, because of the rural nature of our operations, many people do not want to go to the rural area. It's you know, the areas are very challenging, no lighting, no transport, no power, and then little pay. So there are so many factors that kind of keep the teacher away from that kind of environment. And so how do we deal with the children that are in the rural area, the children that we want to support, to provide an education to? So, you know, there has to be some motivational aspects that we need to work at. We are trying to put teacher houses. We are trying to say, okay, let's pay the teachers on time compared to what the government probably does. But I think there's still a lot more work to be done.
Okay. Yeah. And Guillaume, are we in a position where, you know, we're talking about digital technologies. Are they important at all in Brazil in education?
Well, they're beginning to be increasingly more important. I just don't know if we are doing it properly. Like, the government is trying to put, not iPads, but tablets in the hands of children right now. And that's becoming huge. But like, teachers are not trained to do the talk and chalk business at all. So how are you going to just put iPads on their hands and that's going to work? So there's a long way to go in really integrating this technology into classrooms. There's a long way to go in providing the right tools and the right way of using those tools. So that's where I think that technology is not being correctly integrated into schools. And in Brazil, that's a big problem. That's
so
big
we're
issue.
Still in the very early stages of this experiment that we're talking about in education.
Yeah, right? it's really early stage, and like it's not happening in a lot of places. And a lot of this comes from connectivity problems like Uganda, and students are not really getting the appropriate feedback on how to use those tools. Not teachers are not using it properly and not having the feedback to use those. So it's really early stage. We don't know how exactly that's gonna play. We just know that government wants kids to have these tablets, right. And that's it.
Okay. Penny, let me ask you, we've seen lots of questions being raised about education. Do you feel you've seen any good answers?
Yes. I've seen lots.
I'm glad you say that.
probably,
there's hope, and hope matters.
Probably the most exciting school I've ever visited was serving street kids in the slums of New Delhi. It was an absolute delight. I saw teenagers who had only been in this school for 2 years passing the state examination. And I said to the principal, so how come they can get to do algebra and calculus? And she looked at me as if I was from the moon, and she said, just because they weren't in school, don't assume they weren't learning. Right? And I think that's a key point here, that the tools available to us, and I've seen incredible classrooms, I've seen incredible schools. There are a few brilliant schools in Canada, in the USA, and I'm sure in every country in the world.
Yeah.
One of the things that concerns me, though, is so many of them, the only vehicle for getting them established seems to be to find the mechanism for them to opt out or to be started from scratch.
Right.
And what I'm looking for are, what are the strategies that we would put into place to transform existing high schools into places of deep learning for teenagers, wherever they are?
Well, that's exactly why we're here, so that's great.
Well, I'm counting on you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have time for today. If you're interested in learning more about what our summit participants have to say, make sure you join us online on our website tomorrow morning for a lively discussion with four young people who took their education into their own hands. It's called Smart Kids Are Doing It For Themselves, and it'll broadcast tomorrow at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time at wgsi.org and tvo.org. And if you want to, you can join in our Twitter conversations at hashtag EQX13 and hashtag Learning2030. And if you miss any of the great content that's coming up, do catch it online every day at wgsi.org using the video tab. So I'd like very much to thank our panelists, Graham Brown-Martin, Guillaume Sintra, Penny Milton, and Susan Opok for their insights. And thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Michael, for introducing us to the major themes to be addressed this week. Ladies and gentlemen, particularly those of you who are joining us online, this wraps up the Equinox Summit opening session. But please, we invite you to join us online for daily plenary sessions and tune into TVO's The Agenda with Steve Paikin. You can find the schedule and specific topics, as Michael mentioned, online at wgsi.org and tvo.org.